if in my high moments I have done some good, offered some service, shed some light, healed some wounds, rekindled some hope, or stirred some warmth of apathy and indifference, or in any way along the way helped somebody, then this campaign has not been in vain.
With your host, Andrew Gordon.
Welcome, Cheka. How do I say your last name?
It's Angifinario.
Angifinario.
Hey. Close enough.
I love it. Welcome to the show. Is that your married name or maiden? That's some name there.
Well, yeah, it's my maiden name, and I am married, but at that point in my life, I got married, you know, I was 36 or so. So I was like, you know, I'm used to this name. And my husband was like, cool. Yeah, he was great with that. And so, you know, that was that. So
what's your husband's name, last name?
His name is Brian Farless. He also goes by his last name, which was another factor. So everybody calls him Farless.
That's a little bit simpler than your last name. Now, I was in the same situation with my wife, and I made the same offer that your husband Brian did. I said, look, you're your own person.
Right.
I'm not so a traditional where I have to say, no, you must take my name. Whatever.
Like, right. Yeah.
That's just me. You know, I'm no judgment to anyone who follows the old school.
Right.
It's all good. My thing with her was, your last name is Squicciarini.
Wow.
Yeah. So when you said your name, I was like, it's nothing. That's nothing.
Yeah. Mine is actually very phonetic. People just get overwhelmed because there's so many letters.
Right. Unless you're from New York or Boston or anywhere where there's a concentration of Italian people.
Right. Right. Yeah. True.
I did want to ask you about your first name, Cheka. An interesting name. And I wanted to know what background that's from. Now, based on your last name, I know you are at least part Italian, but what about Cheka?
Yeah. So my actual name is Francesca.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have me fooled.
Yeah, and Cheka, I mean, I never used Francesca, though I love that name, but the story is that I could not pronounce my name when I was a little kid. And also, my brother is named Marcello, my sister is named Maria, and I couldn't say Cheska, so I called myself Macheka. That's what I said. And my siblings sort of dropped off the ma and just started calling me Cheka, so that's been my name my whole life.
Are your parents first generation off the
boat? Nope. Just very into Italian names.
Yeah, because those are like, I mean, every single name is like, there's no mistaking. Those are Italian names. Nothing wrong with them. Just say.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely no mistaking. Yeah.
All right. You don't own any carding companies, do you?
No.
Okay. I'm just saying. I'm here in Charlotte. So for those of you who don't get that, at least here in America and around the world, in Charlotte, the city takes care of the garbage. So it's all run by the city of Charlotte, North Carolina. But on Long Island and in New York, maybe perhaps think you're from Boston, correct? Is that where you are now?
North of Boston. Yeah, I'm in the suburbs.
Long Island, the garbage trucks always had names on them like Graziano's Carding. And then as I got older, I was like, that's weird. Like all of the garbage trucks have Italian names. I guess they just got into the industry early.
I guess so.
Not that anything else is going on, because I know nothing.
Right, right. I know nothing. I'm not familiar with the industry.
Especially speaking to you, Cheka. Just know nothing.
Nothing.
But I do like it. It's a cool take on the name Francesca. And Francesca is a beautiful name. And you could have been the pitch girl for Francesca Rinaldi. Or is it Francesca?
Oh, yeah. No, I got that a lot as a kid. I actually got teased about that. The kids would call me Francesca Rinaldi in school.
Yeah. And again, since this show is global, who knows how many people know that reference, but just to give it some credence, it's the spaghetti sauce, and these commercials were famous, and they used to be like, the mother yelled for the kid's name. I can't remember the kid's name right now, though.
Oh, no, I don't remember either.
Okay. Go on YouTube, who's ever listening, and find Francesco Rinaldi commercials. They were like the staple of, you know, I think we're around the same age because we know those commercials.
Right, right.
And it's like, Billy! I know it wasn't Billy, you know. Growing up in neighborhoods, at least where I'm from, and I imagine where you're from too, and that's what that commercial is based off of, is the mom's yelling for her kid that it's dinner time.
Yeah.
And I remember playing in the street. Street hockey was our big one. Mm-hmm. And everyone's mom, particularly the Italian moms in the neighborhood. And I'm being for real. Like, in my head, there's two that stuck out. And it was always, Brian! Christopher! And those were two separate families and moms who were both very Italian. Yeah.
We had a dinner bell. My mom, she got tired of calling our name, so she got this bell, and she would just ring it when it was dinner time. And we were, like you said, we'd all be out in the neighborhood, you know, in those days, just playing wherever, and we'd all hear the bell and come running home for dinner.
Oh, that's so brilliant.
Yeah.
She saved her voice.
Exactly.
You have always been passionate about being in nature and spending time with your family, both human and furry members. You're an animal person.
Yes.
And you consider yourself equal parts homebody and travel nut. Now, with all those things in mind, which there's about five or six pieces of that quilt that we just spoke about, mm-hmm. would you say that all of those were pieces of the fabric of your childhood?
Yeah, for sure. I was definitely fortunate to have both of those pieces, you know, a really strong home life, really wonderful family, and always dogs. We always had dogs and other animals too sometimes. But we weren't the type of family that was like globetrotting. We didn't have that sort of lifestyle or resources, but we were always doing whatever we could. So things like one of the things we did a lot of summers was rent a big Winnebago. Yeah. And just drive all over New England and up into Canada and just explore.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I always had that balance of like really loving the cocoon of home and family and that kind of bond, playing cards, you know, all that kind of stuff, but also always really being encouraged to go out and have adventures.
Yeah, that's really cool that you got the travel bug and you didn't have to be from an extremely wealthy family just jet setting, like you said.
Right.
We can be creative in our ways to travel. All you got to do is just, well, I mean, now you can just travel in your mind. You know, if you're practicing meditation or yoga, or we have the internet now, you know, finding a local place that you could be away within a cityscape and find a little bit of nature if that's what you're looking for, or it doesn't always have to be so complicated.
Right. I totally agree.
So 10 years ago, you left the corporate world to teach yoga full time. What were you doing in the corporate world?
At that time, I was 29, and I was working for a company that was a wonderful company that was, you know, it was the corporate world, but it was a very small business. It was in the education world. And so we worked with teachers, helping them to find jobs.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful job. I met amazing people there, but it was for me, after 3 years there, that was maybe my third job out of college. After 3 years, I just was like, you know, it was honestly just too much at a computer. And I could just feel a really strong pull almost physically that was not where I was meant to be. So that's when I decided to make a transition, which wasn't actually that I immediately was making a transition to yoga. I just knew I needed to do something different. So I left and then ended up going to live at a yoga retreat in Hawaii, where I spent about a year. But again, my intention had just been to sort of rethink things and get my feet on the ground and de-stress and all of that. But through that journey, fell so much in love with yoga that then I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Were you practicing yoga prior to your getaway for yourself?
No, not really. It was like an occasional thing. I was like, oh, sure. Like, I'll go to a yoga class after work, you know, like it wasn't, you know, it's just a very once in a while. I really hadn't like caught the bug at all.
When you're in Hawaii, was your intention to practice yoga or just to go to Hawaii and like chill and find the pieces and put them all together?
So the reason I ended up at that yoga retreat, it was called Kalani Oceanside Retreat. It's on the Big Island of Hawaii. And my best friend from high school was the kitchen manager there at the time.
Okay.
And they'd had like a work trade program. So you could come work and that would pay for your food and lodging. And I was like, okay, I'll do some yoga. That sounds cool. But again, it wasn't kind of my main thing. So it was because I knew someone there and I had always wanted to go to Hawaii. So I was like, well, this sounds perfect.
Sure.
So that's how I ended up at that particular place. But within the first week, I had started practicing yoga most days, twice a day. And that, you know, everything just it was just like, where has this been my whole life kind of thing. Even though I kind of dabbled in it before, just to be doing it in that setting. And I had a couple of really wonderful teachers when I was there. It just almost immediately became like an integral part of my life.
Can I ask you, besides being in Hawaii, let's put that aside, because mm-hmm. it's a beautiful place to be practicing yoga in itself. But that aside, your mm-hmm. first experience with yoga coming in as an adult, leaving the corporate world, what was the major thing about yoga that hit you as something that was much different than anything else that you did? Like, what was that one trigger, that one thing? Oh,
that's such a good question. I was actually just telling this story in my class a couple of days ago, after class, to somebody. And I feel like it's sort of a common yoga story. But for me, the reason I think that at first it all made sense was that I had grown up pretty athletic, you know, always playing sports and competing and that sort of stuff. So I was comfortable sort of in my, you know, using my body in physical modalities. So, but what I, you know, kind of when I delved into yoga, I noticed, okay, this is a way to kind of celebrate the beauty of being embodied in a non-competitive manner.
Yes.
So that was first thing that I was like, this is wonderful. I'm not trying to achieve anything or, you know, beat anyone yet at yoga. I'm just celebrating this embodiment. So that was sort of the first thing. But I think what was really a pivotal moment for me, where it was like, okay, this is not only interesting as a physical pursuit, but I remember very specifically one day I was in half pigeon pose and I started to have tears just streaming down my face. And I actually didn't feel sad, but I mean, streaming, a fountain of tears.
That's the part of the story you said that most people have heard before, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I actually remember going up to my teacher after class and saying, Jared, I was just sobbing in that pose. Like, what's happening? Like, I don't even feel sad. This is, I was kind of freaked out, you know?
And he takes out Kleenex from his yoga pants.
Yeah. Says,
pigeon, I bring my Kleenex when we hold it long in class. Here you go.
Exactly. He was totally like, don't even worry about it. Like, this is, you know, it's a great...
It's beautiful, though. Yeah. It really is. It's so great to release all that pent-up energy and emotions and memories that are stored in our connective tissue. And that's what's really happening. And it's so hard to access those areas in a lot of other modalities. But in yoga, by the time you get to that pose, if it, you know, a well-sequenced class or your body's just particularly open, yeah, that could happen.
Totally. And that really is the answer to your question. That was, I forget exactly the words you used, which were so beautiful, but you know, that was the moment. What's that?
I said, oh, stop it.
That was the moment where I sort of realized this is something deeper, you know?
So
I know you said to separate Hawaii from it, but I just have to mention that I do think that setting can be impactful. And I do think that being in a place that really had hit my soul so deeply just kind of set the stage for me to have that sort of release, because I felt so safe and so comfortable and free, you know?
Of course, I'm not knocking Hawaii, because I would love to be practicing in Hawaii right now. However, it just struck me that your first experience ever in yoga was there.
Yeah.
So to ask that question in this particular case, I would have to separate Hawaii out of the equation,
right,
to get some sort of answer to pinpoint it to yoga. And I'm glad that I did. Thank you for actually pulling that out for me.
Yeah.
After your retreat in Hawaii, you went on to lead retreats starting in 2011. And mm-hmm. you knew immediately that you found your calling. How did you end up leading retreats? How does one go about that path?
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually when we had been kind of communicating before. Yes. This, because so I started teaching yoga in 2008, and I was a little bit of a, you know, different story than I hear often, because I was kind of into it full time right away. I finished my teacher training and started teaching full time right away, and it was actually student driven. So I had, I've been teaching for a few years, and I had a group of students that were really wonderful, close-knit group, actually at MIT, the school here in the Boston area.
You have to be really smart to go there. So I've only heard of it.
Well, I didn't go there. I just taught you.
I heard it exists. It's something like that. I don't know.
they were asking about it. You know, I think they had sort of heard about yoga retreats and asking if maybe we could do one. And to be honest, at the time I was kind of like, oh gosh, I don't really know the first thing about that or setting those up or how it all works. I did have a good friend named Laura Swan who I taught with, who had done a bunch of retreats. And so I brought it up to her and I'm like, do you think I could do this? She's like, totally. You know, she really encouraged me. That's basically what happened. So we were in the Boston area. So I wanted to do something that was, you know, not too hard to get to. So I found this beautiful retreat center in Vermont, which I still go to. I think I've led close to 20 retreats there now. It really feels like a very special
place. Which one is it?
It's called Sky Meadow Retreat.
Very cool. Okay. Yeah. I want to check that out.
Oh yeah. It's wonderful. I love it there. Going again this fall, we go every year, but yeah, so it was really, I have to credit that group of students. They were the ones who kind of planted the seed and that's how it all got started.
So once you start teaching retreats and you're a retreat leader at this point, how do you find, I know why you picked that place, it was close, but how do you initiate the process of hosting a retreat and finding a place to host it and having them agree to it? How does that whole thing work? And I know now there's a lot more resources for that, but for people that might be considering it, what do you do?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many retreat centers out there now and so many people leading retreats. So I think that there is a fit for everybody. But, you know, I think one thing I would say is to give yourself plenty of time to plan. I think that's really important. I think these things can be hard to kind of throw together at the last minute. And to think about, especially if you're newer to leading retreats, you know, really think about your student base and where and how they might like to travel. Because I feel like, you know, there's so many different types of teachers and students who gravitate towards those teachers. So, you know, that's the first thing. In other words, I guess what I'm saying is to be mindful in even choosing the retreat center that you want to reach out to. Because I think there's, you know, we're in the age of Instagram and all this stuff, and there's so many beautiful pictures out there and places that seem very appealing. But it's sort of like a matter of, you know, doing your homework before you even start the process, if that makes sense.
Yes, no, I get it.
Totally. Yeah. And so to, you know, so that once you're starting to talk with a place that you have, you know, a strong level of interest, to make it work out. So, I what's happening too is because yoga retreats have become such a popular mode of travel, in my experience, retreat centers, at least the ones that I love to work with, you know, really have their ducks in a row. And so once you kind of reach out and propose what you'd like to do, usually you're going to get a pretty solid list of things or parameters that they need or what their pricing is and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think that's good. I mean, that being said, you know, one of the reasons that I started Yoga Way was to help people navigate all of that, but also because I have enjoyed working in some less typical situations where there isn't necessarily even a retreat center, because I think that can be really fun too. For example, I go to Block Island every summer, co-led with my friend Caroline. There isn't a retreat center there. So on Block Island, we worked to put together different food and lodging and practice space and activities to kind of create a retreat of our own. So sometimes there's that too, which is can be a little trickier or just maybe a little more time consuming than working with like a turnkey retreat.
And I also think that someone with your experience would have an easier time putting something like that together. And, you know, that's the value that you offer, is that you have this experience that you could do something like that. And I was going to ask you, you brought it up, but your company is Yoga Way Retreats. Mm-hmm. And I saw that little piece about that you help other teachers put together retreats, which is cool. And you just mentioned that. What are some other things that make your company not just a retreat company?
To me, so we talked back, you were asking about the very first retreat that I led and how I knew that was sort of my calling. And what I really love about retreats, yes, there are beautiful places that you can travel to, but it's the community and the friendships that I think are the most important and the most, honestly, just the most beautiful to experience. It's why I never tire of leading retreats or organizing them or being on them. Because it's such a beautiful thing. I feel like as adults, how often do we really get that opportunity to form deep bonds with other adults? You know, so many times we're just kind of crossing paths with people in more superficial ways.
Yes.
So, I love that beauty of coming together in a deeper way. So that really was my my motivation to start Yoga Way Retreats, because I wanted whoever I was working in or whatever wonderful teachers were coming onto the team and being part of it, I wanted our sort of top priority to be a feeling of real inclusivity. And yes, that when you join one of the retreats, it's not just like a trip that you're taking with some other yogis, but you're kind of welcomed into this family for the weekend or the week. And those people hopefully become, you know, at least some of them become longer term friends. And part of this was, brought, sometimes something's happening and you don't even sort of realize it until other people shine a light from their perspective. And I had a few students who would start talking to me about their yoga retreat friends. And like, I would announce a new retreat and they would be texting each other like, hey, are you going on this? Like, we should meet up at this, you know, that sort of, and that was like so beautiful to me. So that's why I wanted to make it a more cohesive set of offerings and also bring in other teachers who had that same desire.
Can I ask you how you come up with the lengths of your retreats? Is there sometimes you've had one where maybe you said that was a little bit too long or that one should have been a little bit longer? What's the sweet spot for you?
Huh, that's a great question. So I think part of it does depend on where you're traveling to and how long it takes to get there and how complicated it is. So for example, for my Hawaii retreats, we do 8 nights.
Yeah.
Because it's just such a long trip, you know, from the East Coast, and usually a lot of people are coming from this area. I actually led a couple of retreats that were, you know, a flight away that were like 4 or 5 nights.
Yes.
And I got some feedback that people would like to have a longer option at least.
Sure.
So, you know, usually for a retreat that you're going to travel on a plane for, I like to do like 6 or 7 nights or at least have an option. You know, you can do a 5 night or you can do a 7 night, which some people like that too, in case they do want the shorter version. And then, for weekend retreats, I think that there are I know for my fellow teachers around here, they're in the Boston area, there are, yes, so many great 2 or 3 night retreat options. And I'm glad we have that variety, because I think some people really enjoy being able to like work a half day on Friday and then come up and not to miss too much work. But 3 nights gives you so much of a better option to like really delve into a longer retreat if you want it. So I think I tend to do 2 night retreats, but I love both of those options. So I haven't really found people too concerned with the length, except for having people want something a little bit longer when it comes to a week.
Now, in your mind, and thank you for answering that in detail, I think that's helpful, not only for myself being curious, but I'm sure there's people listening who want to know more. And you have a lot of knowledge on it, so I want to pose you with some of these questions. So I appreciate the detailed answers as much as you can. If in your mind, what's like one unique, special, memorable experience etched in your head from a retreat that you had? And conversely, what's one experience where something didn't go quite right and may have been a mishap, or it just, you don't have to name names, but it just could be a little anecdote.
So let's see, something etched in my mind of real beauty. Gosh, I feel like there are so many. I'm just going to go with the one that just popped into my head the quickest.
Yes, that's the one to go with.
Okay, so this past summer, we went to Hawaii, to the Big Island. And one of the reasons this is so special is that, you know, there's an active volcano on Hawaii, but you never know exactly what it's going to be doing. It's not going to be erupting violently or anything, but where the lava flow is going, you never know if where it will be exactly or if it will be accessible to go view.
Wow, that's so insane.
Yeah. So I felt really lucky last time because I've spent a lot of time on Hawaii, but it just so happened that this particular retreat, there was a place in Volcano National Park where you could actually ride your bike out and get very close to where the lava was exiting its kind of lava tube and pouring into the ocean.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was just such an amazing sight.
I don't even know what that, I can't tell you experientially what that would look like because I've never seen it. But in my head, I'm visualizing this lava pouring into this water and what that would look like in awe.
Yeah.
I witnessed that.
No, it was, you know, amazing. And actually more amazing for me truly is watching other people see that for the first time. Wow. So that really just to, you know, kind of see the awe and share in the awe was a pretty wonderful experience. So there are lots, but that one definitely is a kind of one that's fresh in my mind.
Now I feel bad going to ask you about one of the mishaps or less fortunate moments, but you know, they do happen. Anytime you have a group of people together for 4 or 5 days or so, it's going to be all high fives the first day or two. And like food, things kind of spoil or can spoil after 3 days. So there had to be one or two times that something happened that was a little like,
oh. Oh yeah, for sure. It's funny that you mentioned food because, I think that's a really important thing. And there have been a couple situations where, I can remember one specific situation where there was some miscommunication about our group's needs in terms of like dietary preferences, allergies, and things like that.
Sure.
It's just in our, you know, in communicating before the retreat, some wires were crossed. We were able to sort it out, you know, 2 days into the retreat. So it all ended up okay. But I think that's really, really important. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that's like a lesson learned because I'm a sort of person, I'm very, I don't want to like bother people. You know, I'm coming out of this a little bit, coming a little more into my confidence, but I'm just in general, the sort of person who can sort of not want to feel like I'm like nagging. But in this role, as a retreat coordinator and leader, I've, you know, learned what is really important and to make sure is crystal clear before going into a retreat. So like food is one of the things that I will, obviously ask people really far ahead of time if they have any allergies or dietary restrictions and really work with wherever who's cooking for us to make sure that they're aware of that and everything's covered. And do you as the chef have any questions? How can I help? That sort of thing. Cause I do think it's crucially important because you're going to go away for 2, 5, 7 days, whatever it's important to be well nourished. And I understand why that's a top priority for people. So that is actually the situation that came to mind. And the other things, you know, sometimes, I mean, this is completely obviously out of your control, but weather's a thing. I mean, you don't know. You don't know what weather's going to be. On that same Hawaii retreat I was just talking about, there was a storm system off of the coast, you know, for the first like 4 days of our trip. And it never actually, you know, hit the island at all, but it was, you know, it was kind of blustery and cloudy. Mm. That's why it changes a lot like that. But I know that sometimes people are going, you know, they're looking for all sunshine and that sort of thing on a retreat. So, you know, there's things like that might affect an experience.
You ever get those people who are like, I want my money back. The weather wasn't good.
No, no, definitely not. Definitely not. I feel like, I mean, that's a great thing about yoga retreats. You know, you're getting yogis going on them. So, people are usually pretty willing to go with the flow.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. And I'm also glad to hear that no one fell off a cliff. I was like, please don't tell me.
Oh my gosh, please, no. Not that good.
The food thing was just right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you do hire teachers for your retreats, which is unique and different than hiring teachers for a studio or a gym or you fill in the blank. So how do you go about hiring teachers for a retreat setting? What specifically do you look for teachers that would be hosting retreats for your company?
So, you know, that Yoga Way is pretty new. You know, we really just launched in August. So.
Well, congratulations too.
Yeah. Thank you. So it's the people that I'm working with now are generally yoga teachers that I've collaborated with before and, have a pretty close-knit relationship with already.
What's your dog's name?
I know. I'm sorry. Do you want me to go? I got to go.
No. Look.
I have two dogs, Bocce and Banjo.
What kind of dogs are they?
They are like Australian cattle dog, Australian shepherd mixes. They're both rescue dogs. And so I don't know exactly how old they are, but like maybe 5 or 6 years old. And here they come.
We'll work around their barking. Maybe they want to start leading some of your retreats. They heard you talking.
They would not be a good retreat leader. So that's really the people that I'm working with right now are people I've worked with before and that share this passion for the community and the inclusivity and all of that that I was talking about before. So I think that going forward as Yoga Way hopefully continues to grow, that will be, from my point of view, the top priority. But also I want it to feel like a really fruitful relationship for them. So that I work right now, I don't work with a huge variety of locations. Again, that's something that I want to sort of organically expand over time.
Sure.
But you know, do you resonate with the places that we're traveling to? Our retreats are not huge. They're between like 15 and 25 people. So
that's a nice amount of people, but yeah. I don't know the retreat world, but to me that would seem nice.
Yeah. So I want it to be really, you know, very mutually beneficial. And the people that I'm working with right now, what I'm loving is that we're in touch all the time. Like I probably texted with 4 of the teachers before we spoke today. So I don't know. I mean, to be honest, and maybe I shouldn't like admit this, but I don't have like this, you know, I have to get to XYZ with Yoga Way in the next 5 years. I just want it to be kind of organic. And I'm not interested in like necessarily getting it to be huge or anything like that, but I'd rather see a tight-knit group of people sharing a mission, really.
I think that is what I got from looking at your website when we first communicated and also our communications in general. And I think that's what's going to help it actually grow organically, is that I don't get that sense from you that you're looking to be a taker. You're looking to be a giver. So when we come from that place, especially in business dealings, a lot of people want to come from the take place first. And it's very clear and obvious. You start to notice the signs of those people. And I was listening to a talk from Gary Vaynerchuk, and I'm reading his new book. And if you know him.
I don't, actually.
He's like I love Tony Robbins. He's like the, you know, the social media Tony Robbins, like the younger generation. But he's good. Yeah. And he talked about how human nature overall is to be selfish, right? So he's like, don't fake being altruistic. Some people are more altruistic than others, but if you could at least, for the most selfish person, to get themselves to sincerely be 51% altruistic and 49% selfish, you'll be better off than faking 75% altruistic and 25% selfish.
Right.
What I got was, you know, that you are coming from the place of altruism, and that doesn't mean charity, you know, let's not confuse the two. Running a business is to be profitable, but you don't have to do it in a way that is, I'm just going to take, and I'm not going to look for mutual benefit for both parties. And I'm sure you just started this business, but just dealing with other businesses through your retreat experiences in the past, you can tell the type of people you want to work with and the type of people that maybe might not be a good fit for you.
That's right. And I feel like in the yoga world in general, and I don't think it's all specific to the yoga world. It's just what I know, because it's what I've been immersed in for 10 years. And I think, you know, we want to, any one of us as a yoga teacher, any running a yoga business, of course we want to feel that we are being supported by what we do so we can live and all of that kind of stuff. But at the same time, you know, I've really chosen opportunities and collaborations a lot based on my gut of like, do we both want to make this work? You know, is this something where we're going to feel fulfilled by it? And I think that served me pretty well, as opposed to just looking for like the highest money opportunity or something like that. Because I don't know, I just feel like when you find those sweet relationships, you never know where they're going to lead. You know, for me, it's really important before Yoga Way too, to feel like I have coworkers. I mean, that's how I feel. I feel like my fellow teachers that I do stuff with and that have my back and I have theirs, we're coworkers, because otherwise I'm all by myself and I don't want that. So
I was a studio owner and it can be very isolating. You
yes.
know? It's I'm happy I'm married because I have my wife to talk to on some of the rougher days. But other than that, it's an island unto itself.
And exactly.
It can be difficult.
Right.
It can be difficult.
Right.
And, very lonely.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. They all hate me.
No, it's hard. I know. I totally get it. So that's why working with other people is so important to me. Yeah.
And for my world with the podcast, it's funny because I love doing this so much. And especially coming out from, I left my studios in January. Okay. And I just had enough. And
yeah.
I did radio, and then all of a sudden I was asked to be a guest on a podcast by chance. And I was like, man, that was fun. When I started looking around podcasts, like I was helping him with his from altruism, that sparked my radio bug. I want to go back into this. And what I realized was there's a space to talk about yoga and life and use the passion and the altruism that comes with yoga to share. And that's why the questions I ask you are, yes, I'm curious about them too, but a lot of people are listening in my mind would want to know the same answers. So that's what I'm giving, I feel, in this sense, as well as giving you promotion. But when someone comes to me, and I've had no problem getting guests on a show,
yeah.
in just over 2.5 months of existence, we have over 18,000 streams. Now, I don't boast those numbers, but they are big. But when someone comes to me after I ask them to be on the show, and they can feel free to promote whatever they want, and the first answer I get back is, what's your reach? How many listens do you have?
What?
Oh, no, this happens. And I told somebody yesterday, it was someone that has, and I don't want to put the person on blast, but it's someone that has a studio and they do trainings. So I wrote back, well, how much do you make from each training? How many people do you get in each training? Tell me that, and then I'll tell you.
Yeah, right.
They're like, I don't think that's an appropriate question. I go, well, your lead-in question really wasn't great either, because you're only looking to ask me what you could take. And
right.
what I'm giving you is a chance to promote whatever you want to promote. So listen to my show. If you like it and you believe in it, go with your gut. But right. if that's your first question, then you're not someone I'm interested in having on a show. And quite honestly, there's no shortage of guests.
Right.
And that's just the New York coming out of me, but it's not.
No, I think that, you know, that's sort of what it's tough, you know, because I think there's so many, everyone's, you know, trying to make it. I mean, we're in this world full of entrepreneurs, you know,
yeah.
I get that, but then it's just like what you said. I think it's go with your gut. You know, I mean, it's funny. I actually had this, recently I've been thinking there are all these cool, like museum yoga events that go on in the Boston area, with these classes hosted at museums. And I found myself thinking recently, like, you know, oh, I want to go do that. How can I get, you know, how can I get into one of those teaching slots? Like, that sounds really fun. Like, that'd be so cool to go to Boston and do. And I kept thinking about it, but I was like, well, I just don't know. Like, I don't want to like force it. You know, I don't have friends at a museum or whatever. You know, I was just kind of like, well, okay, that would be cool, but just don't force it. You have other cool things going on, just, you know, whatever. And then just last week, I got an email from someone at the Museum of Science that wants me to come and teach for their Pi Day, you know, on March 14th, they have Pi
yes.
Day. And it was like,
I didn't know that, but I said yes.
Yeah. No, I just didn't know if you knew Pi Day was like a cool holiday now, because I didn't really know that. But
yeah. No, but I pretend it is.
So anyway, but it was just one of those funny things, and of course I'm going to go do it, and I'm so excited because it's the perfect museum for me. Like, I love the Museum of Science, but it was just one of those things where it's like, okay, well, this is kind of a cool idea, but I'm not going to like, I don't need to like aggressively force it to happen. And then it just kind of happened. Do you know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. Yeah. I totally know what you mean. And if it has to be forced, it probably isn't right.
Right.
And going back really quickly, just to something that is carried over into this podcasting world that I remember from my radio days, and I was on commercial radio and had a morning show. We would have all different levels of guests in terms of celebrity value or, you know, how big they are as a musician. And what I found in general, not as fact, but it turned out that the lower up on the rung of hit records or fame or success or longevity of career, the one hit wonders, they tended to be not as necessarily engaging or not as nice. Like James Blunt, you know, you're beautiful.
Yeah.
We did mornings, you know, so we woke up at 4 a.m. every day and we did our show from 6 to 10. And he was supposed to call right at 10. Like, you know, we're going to record it. The dude doesn't call. Like, and we want to get out of the studio, go have lunch. And, you know, like you're on the air for 4 hours concentrating intensely.
Yeah.
And you are zapped. And we're waiting. And finally he calls at 11. So we read online that he is his name's Blunt and he's a big weed smoker. So we were just so irritated.
Yeah.
The whole time we spoke to him, we're like, dude, you totally flaked, man.
Yeah.
What happened, bro? Did you get the munchies? And he was getting so pissed. Yeah. And eventually we're just, yo, Blunt, man, that's so crazy. Your name's Blunt. Like you smoke. Like, oh, we wouldn't talk to him about his song or his career. Just, we didn't even, anyway, the music label person was pissed off and spoke to my program director. And we were like, well, whatever, screw him. And then to contrast that to Will Smith,
oh, yeah, I read about that in your
thing. Yeah, so the way it went down with Will Smith was we had a hotline in the studio. So if the hotline rang, it was either my program director or it was like usually if we knew we had an interview coming up, if we answered the phone, instead of saying the radio station name, we just say hello, right? It could be the engineer or the program director or the person's PR rep, right? Mm-hmm. If it was, we're on the air and I answer the phone like, hello. And I think I used my initials at that for most of my career. Someone just said, use AG.
Uh-huh.
Andrew, I was like, what? Okay, whatever. So I was like, hello? He's like, is this AG? He's like, yeah, who's this? And it was just the hotline, you know? It's like, it's not my boss. He's like, what's up? It's Will Smith. And that's what made him so cool is that it wasn't like, hey, this is Julie from Polygram Records or whatever.
Right. Right?
You know, like, hang on a second and play that power move. So he just called and we went right into it. And contrast that to James Blunt. And, you know, where I could talk to Will Smith and where are you right now? What are you doing? I'm in bed with my son, Jaden. We're just hanging out. And
oh.
I mean, because he's so secure in his skin. And he's truly an altruistic person if you start to read about him and the way he lives his life. That to me, just like your business, will grow organically because when you come from that place, like I truly believe he did and still does, success will follow you. Where as opposed to what's James Blunt doing now? I don't know. Nothing against him if you like him, but I haven't heard from him recently.
I know. It's like, who knew the Fresh Prince was going to become like the inspirational person he is to all of us? You know, I feel like I don't really follow Will Smith that closely, but I see whenever people post stuff like his, he's always posting these encouraging things and like, you know, it just seems like a really, really cool person.
And it's crazy because the thing about him is that when I interviewed him, it was when the movie Hitch was coming out.
Yeah.
And the song was Switch. So a lot of people didn't know anything about him except he was Fresh Prince and the movie star. But really, he started out as the rapper, as the, you know, the DJ Jazz Jeff for Fresh Prince. And he would literally drive around in Philadelphia, or someone would drive, and they would sell his cassette tapes out of the trunk of the car. He hustled, you know? And then at the end, I asked him to freestyle rap. Now, you know, this was like 2007. This literally could have gone viral at that time through TMZ if I would have leaked it, if he just really couldn't rap, you know? But I beatbox. He's like, what are the
names? Oh my gosh.
He said, what are the names of the people on your show? So it was AG Sean. And then we had some other guy, our intern, Joel.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, all right, I'm ready. So I was like, yeah, I gave him a little beat. And he knocked it out of the park. Now, not only is it cool that he knocked it out of the park, but it's cool that he would do it.
Because right.
That's legit. Like, I have these skills and I'm going to put it out there. I know I'm talking to you when I don't have to do this for you. I don't have to you take this chance. But, you know, he did. And that to me was just like, okay, that's the separation between someone who's going to leave a legacy and someone who's putting back amazing things into the world, as opposed to someone who's coming from a lack perspective, from a take perspective.
Right.
You know, where he was coming from giving. So anyway,
moving. I hope you're not going to ask me to beatbox.
No. Okay. I won't. But I've gotten about all the retreat stuff. You're known for your open heartedness and your easy laugh. You're deeply committed to maintaining a welcoming and inclusive space, which is obviously important for retreats. Can you describe in three words what someone should expect in one of your classes?
Three words. I don't want to use the wrong words. I'm going to go with peace acceptance, and fun.
I love it. I love it. Those are all great.
Yeah.
And they're all different.
Yeah.
I'm going to touch upon something that I do digging and I do research, and I'm going to share something very personal in connection to something that I'm going to bring up that's very personal. Okay. So you wrote for an online publication. I'm not going to mention who it is because every time I would submit something and they'd be like, oh, this. And I knew they were freaking great articles and they would never publish me. So fuck them. I'm not going to give them credit on my show.
Okay.
You wrote for an online publication, and at the top it said, our would-be due date is 2 days away. Mm-hmm. I feel tender but full of love. I am changed, but I am whole. I miscarried my first and only pregnancy at age 37. Mm-hmm. I was not terribly far along, but it was a blow. It had been a long journey to get that far. But in that moment, it felt as if my husband and I were walking hand in hand, a path that just vanished in an instant mid-step. Now, listen, I know that's tough, and here's why. I know how tough it is. My sister-in-law went through that multiple times. Mm-hmm. And my wife, who is the youngest daughter of the family, felt the pain of her sister.
Yeah.
And finally, they did end up having a baby boy with like 6 months ago.
Mm, nice.
But because of what you just wrote about and what she would talk with her sister about, right, and my brother-in-law, my wife is donating her eggs. And wow. that doesn't mean that we're never going to have kids, but we're not having them right now.
Wow.
Right?
So yeah.
She's literally going, and it's not like taking eggs out of a carton and dropping them off on a counter for someone and be like,
yeah, I know it isn't. Yeah.
So they have to vet you, you know, and like really put you through psychological tests and your genetic test, like your bloodline and all these physical examinations. And I was like, geez, no one would ever want my baby. I was like, because, you know, she's never done any drugs. She's never smoked. She never drinks wine. But, you know, she would be someone who you would want their genes, I suppose.
Right.
So she's going through that process and she's almost done with it. We have the extraction coming up.
Wow.
In a couple of months. And for that one, I'm going to come down to Miami with her where she's doing it. I didn't have to come with her for the last one, which is just... they did a pap, just some examinations. It's a lengthy process, but the truth of it is we don't know who the baby's going to. There is a family that picked her for her eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's beautiful. And people ask me, like, what was my reaction? You know? And of course, at first, when she told me she wanted to do it, I was like, okay. It caught me off guard. And I said, well, will you ever be able to have kids if we ever wanted to? And quite honestly, I don't think either of us really want to.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Things could change. I never thought I'd get married.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, no, it doesn't, at least for the first time you do it. So that should be okay.
Yeah.
Into that. I said, are you okay with this? Like, what do you truly feel about this? Like, you know, this is a process. So I know in your heart, you want to do this because you're passionate about helping in this way that you can. But have you really sat with this thought for a while? Like, you know, are you okay? And mm-hmm. I just wanted to check how she was with that. And then once she was, I was fully supportive. I was like, all right, cool. You know, like,
yeah, that's amazing.
Because some people get weird, you know, and they say things to her like, well, don't you feel weird that part of you is going to be out there and you don't know who? And I'm like, and me as her husband, I'm like, who cares? Like, are you insane? You know, she's giving that gift to people who really want it.
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, I think that's amazing. And you're, you know, just like you said, it's a huge commitment for her on every level. But you know, there's something I was just talking about this weekend too, you know, for people who want to have families, there's so many beautiful ways to do it, you know, and she's facilitating that for another family, which is amazing.
It is. And I have the utmost respect for her. She came back from that weekend and they did some things which were a little painful.
Mm-hmm.
She's a trooper. And I'm just like, wow, you know, this is amazing of you.
It is amazing.
To do that.
Yeah.
But I know you have a love of family because mm-hmm. of the way you grew up. I know you have a love of kids. And this leads me to my next question about one of your journeys. You got into Radiant Yoga Retreats?
Radiant Child Yoga. Yeah.
Radiant Child Yoga Retreats for Kids, which is located at childrensyoga.com. Can you give me more details about how that goes?
Yeah. So I, you know, I guess about a year before I started leading yoga retreats, I had been, when I started teaching yoga, I taught adult and children's yoga. And then my teacher, Shakta Khalsa, is the founder of Radiant Child Yoga. Yes. And she welcomed me into the facilitator or the teacher training, the teacher trainer program. Nice. So yeah, so that has been huge. So I started leading those in 2010, and I'm a little bit of a hiatus right now because I'm focusing so much on Yoga Way. But yeah, so I've taught children for, you know, for years and years, and now I teach others to teach children. And Radiant Child Yoga specifically was born out of Kundalini Yoga. So it's a little bit different in that regard. So it's got a lot of movements in it that are more, that are really great matches for, especially yes. for young kids, because they're so active. Mm-hmm. There's lots
very
of
very smart.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I mean, that's the thing with kids. I adore kids, and I, what's interesting.
Somebody has to.
Just in regard to this prior conversation we had too, you know, I'm so grateful for children because of what they teach us, you know, yeah. and, just being so present and so in the moment. And I really, it's kind of it sounds funny to say, but I really respect and admire and love children just for the people that they are, you know, and that's been one thing that's interesting about having close relationships with children without having my own, is yeah. just appreciating them for the full-fledged beings that they are. I mean, that's one of the things we talk about in Radiant Child Yoga is that kids are big souls and little bodies. So we may think of them as, they think of them as little, but really they're a full-fledged soul. They just maybe haven't grown to our size yet. So it's been great. And so right now I don't teach 20 classes a week anymore, but when I did, having the balance of kids and adults classes was so important. I don't think I ever could have taught 20 kids or 20 adult yoga classes in a week. It would have just been too much, but to have the variety has been awesome.
Thank you to the teachers who teach kids, because I wish I had as a kid, and
right?
it does so much good for them. Have you ever thought about having a teacher training for teachers who want to teach retreats?
I have thought about that. I was thinking maybe too, to start with something a little smaller, like maybe a webinar, but an interactive one type of thing. What do you think about that idea?
I like that idea. And I think one thing you can do to make it attractive, I have this certification and I never freaking use it. It's mm-hmm. so funny. But the YACEP, what is it? The
continuing. Oh, I have that too, yeah.
Yeah, so you can offer some continuing ed for teachers. Yeah. That I don't even know if it means anything.
Me neither, but I have it.
You know, but I think online would be possibly a good way to go about it. But I say that without the knowledge of what it would entail. So I can say online is great for a lot of things. For a retreat teacher training, I don't know. That only you would be able to know that much more than I would.
One thing I'm doing actually in July 27th to 29th up in Maine, I'm doing my first weekend retreat for yoga teachers. So it's not about leading retreats, but I felt like it was time for there to be something that's actually not, in this case, it's not like a teacher training, you know, it's not part of a 200 hour or anything like that, yeah. but it's just a retreat for yoga teachers. So we can get away and have community and talk about what comes up, what we're worried about, you know, what we're excited about, and just have some support. And I've had a really good response to it so far. So that's, I'm super excited about that. And it's sort of, aside from the Radiant Child Yoga teacher trainings, you know, my first kind of dive into, let's just get together as teachers and talk about how we can grow. And, but I wanted to be clear too with people that it's not like a business retreat. I want it to be more about community, not like, here's how you can make 10% more money or whatever, you know, just like, let's
there's enough of those. Trust me.
Exactly. And I'm not a business coach, but I have been navigating this world for 10 years and have had all these ups and downs. And I just feel like every time I bring something up that is a reality as a yoga teacher, so many people are like, yes, I go through that too. Yes. You know? And so I was like, let's do this. And people are excited. So anyway, that's not exactly what you're talking about, but I'm super psyched for it because I just feel like we need that support, you know, for each other.
Well, again, just like owning a business, sometimes being a teacher it's just you and your class. So that can right. be isolating too. If all you're doing is teaching and you're entering a room full of students, which you're connected with, you know, you love seeing them. But you leave and then that's it. You know, if you're an independent contractor, you're pretty much in your own world too. So it's a weird paradox. You're so connected, but at the same time, you're so alone.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, you know, we all feel that way a lot of the time. So I think it'd be good to get together and talk about it.
Yeah, that is a very, very great idea. Yeah. Well, Cheka Scangeli. Help me out.
It's a scenario.
Check it. Scenario.
Scenario. That's a new one. I haven't heard that one.
No, I'm trying. I really am.
Just call me Cheka A. It's fine.
Cheka A. Okay. Cheka A. So we can find you at yogawayretreats.com, and we'll post the links. Will always be in the show notes, but I mentioned them anyway. Mm-hmm. You did put hashtag freedom friendship flow. What's that all about?
That's our yoga way hashtag. So those, if you go on the website, you'll read in the philosophy that's broken down, but the freedom friendship flow are sort of our main tenets of the mission. So that's our hashtag.
Very cool. Do you want to give out the phone? Is that the phone number to your business or is that personal?
That's my personal phone, but it's right on the website if anyone wants to see it.
Okay. So I'm not going to bore people with digits and numbers, but you know, Yoga Way Retreats, know that. And you can find Cheka Linguini.
Yep, Cheka Linguini.
So it's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Maybe we'll sync up and I will go to one of your retreats. I want to incorporate more of that into my life.
That'd be awesome. Love it.
And feel free to come back. Everyone that comes on the show always has an open invite back. We're all fans.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun and I love your show.
Oh, thank you so much, Cheka. Spread the word.
All right, I will.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Podcast with your host, Andrew Gordon.